You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. And our guest on this episode is Lloyd Darlow. Did I pronounce it correctly?
Yes, you did.
Okay, well, here you go. So Lloyd, the way the show starts is with a huge question. Who are you? What do we need to know about how you aspire to live, the life you've lived, the labels you wear to get to know you?
I'm just a guy from the Bronx who...
Oh, really?
...managed to... migrate around a little bit from the Bronx to New Jersey to Philadelphia to St. Louis, and I made my way back to Ithaca.
Well, you've hit a few places that I've lived. Near anyway. So why do you describe yourself in terms of migration?
Oh, that's a really good question. I wasn't anticipating that one, so thanks for the curveball. I guess life is a journey, right? And part of what's gotten me to this point has been a bit of discovery. I managed to find myself maybe later in life, and that's maybe a message that I wanted to try to get through, to your listeners in the next hour.
Sure. So you started with the Bronx. I'm just curious, where in the Bronx? Because I lived in the Bronx for a number of years.
A long fly ball from Yankee Stadium.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
It's
There's some white apartment buildings there.
My building is long gone. It's a parking lot now. That's been a little bit of a theme throughout my life. It seems that places where I've spent time have basically been kind of razed to the ground.
Right.
And I know my wife and I took a trip a number of years ago back to where her grandparents lived and found the house that her grandmother grew up in that she remembered. I can't do that. The building I grew up with in the Bronx is gone. My medical school was sold, and the building that I trained in is gone. The practice where I really cut my teeth in St. Louis is gone. So it's people say you can't go home again. For me, that's true. In a lot of places, I can't.
Right. And we don't think about it in terms of. The way I'm going to frame it is that I'm kind of a bottom feeder. I kind of grew up kind of hard scrabble sort of way. The farmhouse I grew up in is gone because nobody wanted to live in it, and there's nobody there anymore. Most of the town I grew up nearby is gone because the same way the Bronx, the stories, not necessarily a parking lot. There's just maybe nothing there. It's just grass. And things change. And even if you're a doctor, even if a quote status career of doctor, things change, and the profession and the practice and the facilities that are required change, and not everything gets updated.
That's absolutely true. I think that's one of the reasons. I know we'll probably get into this as we go through even some of the music as to why I've become enamored of Scotland as a country. When we visited there, what struck me, my wife and I become castle chasers in a way. We love visiting castles. And we've seen the contrast between the castles that are still lived in as family homes, those that are bought by the National Trust and have become museum pieces, essentially, and those that are ruins. Mm-hmm. And the ruins maybe strike me the most. They maybe get to me, to my soul the most, and try to envision what it was like when it was standing. What did it look like? What were the people like who lived there and worked there and guarded the place? What meant the most to them? So maybe that kind of is why it feeds into me so much, because of these places that I've had that I can't go back to.
Sure. Well, you brought music with you, and so tell me what you want to play and
well, start with the first one. Actually, all the songs are by a Scottish group called Skerryvore, and the first one is a song called "Can You Hear Us?" And boy, when you're from the Bronx, you want to make sure people hear you. whether they like what you have to say or not. I've gotten used to telling my patients at this point. I'll be 60 in a couple of weeks, so I've gotten used now to telling my patients it's not my job to tell you what you want to hear. It's my job to tell you what you need to hear.
So this is
probably the best song to start off with.
Can you hear us? And it just takes a little while to come.
You gotta love live radio.
Yes. Thank you.
together. Stand tall, try to find the strength that lies deep within your heart. There will be an answer rising from the dark. Take your chances, take them all. The battle can be won, but a few must fall. Separate the truth from all the lies that have been thrown. Show the world your face, you are not alone. Cause I wanna know, will you listen to us now? Can you hear us, can you hear us shout? I wanna know that you really understand, that you truly got it figured out. I wanna know, will you listen to us now? That you truly got it figured out. I wanna know, will you listen to us now?
Well, I wanna understand if you truly got it figured out, just like they said in the song there.
Oh man, do I ever not have it figured out? I mean,
so the next question may or may not be for you. Given the life you value now, what did you have to learn from some of those experiences and places you lived? So you have some kind of a clue that this is really the life and that you can tell people what they need to hear and kind of get maybe behind their defenses or also get to calm them so that they can actually hear. What did you have to learn to live the life you value now?
I think the first thing I had to learn was that it hurts to learn important lessons, but if it's not important, then it won't hurt as much.
Right.
I started my career actually as a dentist, thought I would kind
it's
of.
It's funny. Jeff Lewis had the same experience.
it's funny because Jeff Lewis and I were freshmen at Penn together in 1982, and we have different recollections of that first meeting. Isn't that kind of funny how that works out? But I had a lot of relatives who were physicians. No one in my family was a dentist, and I thought I would be the first. I wanted to carve my own path, so to speak, and met an oral surgeon. I thought he was just the bee's knees, and I really wanted to kind of emulate what he did. So worked my way through Penn with the intention of becoming an oral surgeon, like my friend Jeff is. I had the opportunity to go right from dental school into medical school. There was a movement at that time, maybe to, I hate to use the word, legitimize oral surgery a little bit more, but in an academic environment like Penn, you needed that kind of, you know, cred.
You needed the MD cred
to be taken seriously, exactly. Yeah. And, you know, they were looking to do more facial reconstructive type stuff, and that was really what I was interested in. So I went right from dental school right into medical school in Philadelphia. And went through the process, got to my last rotation as a medical student was in family medicine. And worked with a guy in Germantown, if you know anything about Philadelphia. Mm-hmm. It was kind of the depressed area at that point. You know, there was a lot of white flight that had taken place at that point.
abandonment again?
Abandonment, exactly. But, you know, the patients of this guy who I worked with, they had moved all to the suburbs, but they came back to Germantown, you know, to see him. And I was just unbelievably struck by the relationship that a physician could have with a patient. And that, I'm a big believer in the aha moment. I've had a few of those in my life. That was the first. I mean, literally, the light bulb went off. And it was the first time that I actually saw myself being able to do something.
What did he do that you saw?
Personal connection. It was just a matter of the way he... And he, to tell you the truth, he wasn't necessarily the nicest guy outside of the office, but in the room, you know, with people, he just had a way of allaying fear, inspiring confidence. It was a relationship. And as a surgeon, I got to tell you, as a relationship, right. you don't want a relationship. Because if you have a relationship, that means you've probably messed things up and they've got to come back and see you. You want to do your job well, and then they don't have to see you again.
Right, right.
You know, so that just really blew me away. And but I was in a position, this is one of the hard things that I mentioned. So Penn had just established this program of dual degree, and I was in the first class that went through it, and I knew that if I bailed on the program, it was going to be a black mark, and maybe the program doesn't survive. So I made the decision, they talk about taking one for the team, you know, so I spent the next 4 years completing what I basically thought was my responsibility, having agreed to do this. But I'm in the oral surgery part of it, and I'm telling you, I got out of bed every day, every single morning, I said a prayer. I would say I'm a spiritual guy, maybe not a religious guy, but I'm definitely a spiritual guy, and I said a prayer every morning. And the prayer was, God, let this be the day that I like it. And the day never came. So now I'm at a point, I have two kids, another one on the way, and I have a mortgage, and I hate my life. And I said to my wife, I've got to make a change. And I'll tell you, my wife has been the angel in my life. I would not be where I am without her. She could have basically told me to take a hike or something even more right. salty. But, you know, she said, okay, what do we have to do? And all the burden fell on her. So I went back to being a resident again, making no money. You know, I calculated my salary as a resident. I was making 50 cents an hour if you put in all the
right,
time.
Right.
My mother, who was not in good health, came to live with us.
To help with the kids?
To help with the mortgage, basically.
Yeah, I see.
Actually, my mother was in bad health, so she didn't help
so
the kids.
She
was
pay for the
she
mortgage,
kind of
yeah.
was a kid.
Yeah.
So my wife
you
is
had
not
five,
only
you had four.
Yeah, my right. My wife is not only raising three small kids; she's also helping with an essentially infirm mother-in-law. And she did it all, and I wouldn't be where I am without her. But, you know, we've always kind of been a team, and we teamed our way through it.
So your 4 years was when you were out and practicing as an oral surgeon?
No, I never practiced. I literally went right from finishing the training. And this is a point that I really want to kind of get through to anyone, anyone who's listening.
Sure.
It take a chance in life. So here's the chance that I took. We decided that, you know, I wanted to be a family physician. I had the training to at least get through the first year of a medical residency, having done a year general surgery.
Right.
So I pick up the phone. We're living in St. Louis at the time. I pick up the phone and the phone book, and there were two family medicine residencies in St. Louis, one affiliated with Washington University,
right,
and one that was affiliated with St. Louis University. So I called the Wash U program first because, frankly, they were the sexier name. And the program director...
Barnes, I think, is the
guy. Yeah, right. The program director was too busy to talk to me, so I didn't talk to him. I next called the one that's from St. Louis University, which was run out of a community hospital called Deaconess Medical Center.
Right.
And
pretty strapped part of Washington.
Yeah, in Dogtown, right. Uh-huh. The Dogtown section of St. Louis. And they put me on hold for the program director. And I'm thinking, now I'm getting nervous. I'm thinking to myself, what am I going to say to this guy? I'm a dentist, oral surgeon with a medical degree who wants to be a family doc. Can you help me?
Yeah. He's can you help me get out of this life?
Well, he's going to think I'm a lunatic.
Overly privileged and not quite finding out where you need to be.
He's going to think I'm a nut and hang up on me. So I almost bailed and hung up first. But sweating bullets, I hung on, and he answered the phone. His name was Jim Nolik, and I kind of blurted it out, maybe not too coherently. And he said, wow, that is a really fascinating story, and I'm really fascinated by your tale. can you come in and talk to me? And I said, yeah, what are you doing in an hour? You know, so I drove in and I met with him and we talked, and he had told me that he was actually intrigued by knowing other physicians over the years who had transitioned out of their medical specialty, right, and become family docs for a lot of the same reasons, for the relationship part of this. Mm-hmm. So the long and the short of it is they offered me a spot in their residency program, which I accepted. And for the next 2.5 years, I got a half a year credit for the work I had done, sure, in general surgery. For the next 2.5 years, Jim basically oversaw my training and put me in positions to get as much experience as I could. They recommended that we moonlight, which was rare. And I took every opportunity that I could, not just because I needed the money, which I did, but I wanted the experience. I wanted to grab it, and I wanted to, mm-hmm, learn as much as I could. So I moonlighted in every rinky-dink, one-stop traffic light town in Missouri to get that confidence experience. But when I left the program, I went right into a practice that was the busiest practice in the city of St. Louis. Within 3 years, I was the third busiest doc in the city of St. Louis, and because I was ready. I had taken the opportunity. So what I would say to people is, if you're nervous about opening your mouth, open your mouth. Take a chance. You never know what someone's going to say, what opportunity is going to be availed to you if you take the chance. If I had never made that phone call,
right,
you and I would not be sitting here today.
Right, right. No, I get it. I get it. And I want to look at some of the steps, but I want to push back just a little bit. Mm-hmm. When it really helps to know who your team is when you open your mouth.
Yeah.
And because the people you speak to first have got to have some chance of hearing you. And then the next people have got to have some chance of hearing you. So when you make that cold call where you're going to be looking like an ass in the middle of nowhere, you're up for it, and you got some people behind you. So it's a stepwise process.
True.
Yeah.
True.
Yeah. So, but that's powerful. Now, how did you get from St. Louis?
Yeah.
To Ithaca.
So I heard your last guest kind of talking a little bit about her concerns about healthcare. I did hear him mention that. In St. Louis, in a small town like that in the Midwest, you wouldn't think this happens, but the pendulum swings really fast there, and the economics of medicine were such that everybody was, you know, hospitals were getting together, even though they didn't have common missions or visions,
right,
to form networks that would last 2-3 years, fall apart.
This is in the 90s?
This is in the mid to late 90s, right. Right. And then all the physicians are now solo docs again, right, and then it kind of goes back and forth. Tenet Healthcare bought our practice. They actually bought St. Louis University. And we were affiliated with SLU, so they owned us. And Tenet really wanted the hospital and the medical school. They really didn't want to own doctors. Right. So they let us know in late 1998 that they were, even though we were the busiest practice in the city of St. Louis, 68,000 visits a year, we were being closed probably around 2001. And my contract was up in 2000. So I remember coming home and saying to my wife, I think I got fired today.
You know what we did a few years ago?
So I actually had been up here. Jeff had invited me up here. Jeff Lewis had been Medical Society president here and had invited me up here not just to visit and hang out with him and his wife, but to lecture. And I'd met a bunch of the doctors here, and I met Neil Shalish, who is my current partner at Family Medicine, mm-hmm, Associates. We had talked just kind of, you know, over the top, you know, hey, would you ever think of coming back to East? And I had, at that point, things were great. And I said, well, you know, I never close a door. Got a good job right now, but hey, you know, who knows? So we stayed in touch over the years. So I come home that day in late 98, and I say to my wife, I got pink slip today. And she said, what do you want to do? And I said, I think I might call those guys from Ithaca. And that night, Neil called me and said, we're thinking of opening a second office, but we need another doctor to do it. Is this a good time for us to talk? And the aha moment again, I said, yeah, this is a great time for us to talk.
Yeah.
And June 23rd, 2000, the moving van rolled into Ithaca.
Wow. Wow. That's a powerful story.
Yeah.
Yeah. Let's cut to music again.
Yeah.
And what are we going to listen to this time?
So, hey, boy, you set this up really well. You're really good, you know? So this is a song called Wit's End. Just when you think you're at your wit's end, you know, maybe you're not. But the best part about this song is the bagpipes. I mean, and Scary Vore have not one but two bagpipers. So you can see they'll kind of build up a little bit and get you ready. And then the bagpipers come in and just blow your mind.
Here we go.
The bagpipe, right? I mean, yeah. Come on.
Yes. You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. Our guest on this hour is Lloyd Darlow. So Lloyd, you talked about aha moments. You mm-hmm. made reference off air to belief in angels. Mm-hmm. What on your end makes it possible for you to have an aha moment? Is it just that you're at wit's end, or is there something about your personality or something about the people you live with or the way you form relationship? What makes aha moments or angels possible?
I think it's being ready to receive gifts that come your way. You know, I mean, opportunity is there. It's always there, even when it's dark. There's an opportunity there someplace. You know, one of my good friends...
There's an opportunity there someplace.
Right, someplace.
Someplace.
One of my good friends, Dr. Marty Stallone, who just became the CEO of Keugan Medical Center, is a guy... I mean, he'll work opportunity into about every conversation that he can. I mean, it's inspiring to talk to people like that. But you have to have your eyes open. And this is what I try to tell my mm-hmm, kids, mm-hmm, what mm-hmm. I try to tell my patients, medical students and residents I've taught over the years. You've got to keep your eyes open. You never know when the opportunity is going to be there or when an angel may be sitting in front of you.
Right.
You know?
Right. Right. And the way you're using the term is something that I did my doctoral work in some of the poorest, most violent neighborhoods in Chicago and Detroit. And these people who were trying to create and control wealth in places where you were more likely to get shot than to get a job. Right. But what they told me was that you know, faith, this attitude of hope and trust, mm-hmm. is opportunistic. And most people don't want to think about their spiritual life as being really an exercise in opportunism. But when you're open to things and you are available, then you see things to act on. And that is the definition of opportunism, right. and opportunistic.
And I try to encourage people as much as I possibly can, you know, be a mentor. Take the opportunity to make a difference in somebody's life. I mean, you really can do that. I mean, I see...
again, how do you...
I've seen a lot of people who could have taken that higher road and chose to not, and that's sad.
Right. So, but I guess... I'm going to push back a little bit. We have a rhetoric of mentorship, which is almost like the keys to the kingdom.
Yeah.
But what it is it's about a willingness to slog through, is more my sense. And maybe that's what you mean by that. How do you be the kind of person that other people would choose? Because the mentor relationship really only works when the person opens up their conundrum. Mm-hmm.
Maybe this isn't where you're going, but I'll see if I can take a stab at it.
Sure. So, and I don't know where I'm going, to be honest.
So when I was in St. Louis in the practice, St. Louis University had started a family medicine rotation for their medical students who needed that. Actually, those who were from California, there were a lot, actually needed to do a dedicated family medicine rotation. Not primary care, not ambulatory medicine, mm-hmm. not internal medicine or peds. It had to be with a family physician. So I was part of the charter faculty. And I had three students over 3 months. One, you know, they would spend a month with me. And the grading system there was honors, pass, fail. So all three students got honors. And we had a rule, basically, which was if there's a chart on the door, you pick up the chart, you knock on the door, you walk in, you introduce yourself as Dr. Darlow's student, and you start going to work. You know, you're here to learn. You're not here to follow me like a little duckling. You're here to, mm-hmm, you know, to work, to learn.
Get out and do some work, and we'll reflect on it.
So, you know, they all did wonderfully. So I got a phone call from the program's manager, who actually had been a past attending of mine as a resident. His name was Mike Rayleigh. And he said, so are you going to give all your students honors? I said, Mike, if we're getting into a quota thing here, you might as well drop me right now. You know, if they do what needs to be done, you're darn right they're going to get honors. You know, and he said, okay, just asking. You know, and he and I never had another conversation about it. But I think almost every student that I worked with wound up getting honors because I gave them the gauntlet. Here, right. I threw the gauntlet down. This is an opportunity for you to work, to learn and to grow. You got to take it, and they took it.
Right,
and they took it.
Right, and the. Okay, so
was that mentoring? I mean, I think it was.
Well, yeah, no. And you were grading them on the quality of their engagement,
mm-hmm.
and not just the outcomes. Because when it comes to medicine, the outcomes are all over the map because we don't control that.
That is the truth.
But you can, to some extent, manage the way in which you engage other people, and you gave them the opportunity and expected them to. Mm-hmm. So when we end up with this objectivist notion,
right,
that this is honors and there's some kind of a bar that we have to get above, then we're not living a subjective life anymore.
Right.
And that's what we need to get over. We have to deal with each other.
Yeah, it's been a great experience to have students and residents in the office. Having patients in the office is even a greater experience.
Uh-huh.
You know, we talked a little bit off air about change and how things have changed. You know, the relationship that you have with the patient as a physician has really changed over the years. There's some geography to that. There's some ethos to that. So in St. Louis, Midwest, you know, doctors don't ever get questioned. You know, and by the way, that's bad. I think that.
Well, and I think, you know, that you could have said the same thing, mm-hmm. in New York City in the 70s or early 80s when I was working with older adults. Mm-hmm. They didn't question.
Right.
Generational issues, and the Midwest is later in that.
But 90 80%+ of my patients in St. Louis were white middle class workers. I had a lot of postal employees. Yeah. I had a lot of policemen. I had the entire Fenton Dodge plant. I had no families of color.
Right, and you also didn't have entrepreneurs, and you didn't have farmers.
I had a lot of farmers.
Oh, you did. Okay.
I had a lot. Okay. We were right on the border of Jefferson County.
Okay. Yep.
So I had a lot of farmers.
And they will question more than some
They were even like, hey, if I was the physician, I wouldn't be here. So whatever you tell me to do, I'm going to do.
Cool.
But then I came here, and now all of a sudden I have Cornell and Ithaca College professors. Now we're also getting to the era of Dr. Google. People are walking in with printouts from the internet, you know. And what I try to tell people is I want you to read, but then I want you to bring it to me. Because everything you encounter that's out there has no context. It has nothing to do with you. It's totally without context. Right. So bring your stuff, read, go ahead, and then before you act on it yourself, bring it to me.
Let's talk.
And, you know, I'm your filter. I'm the prism by which all of this information comes through, and then we get a nice clean shaft of light that comes out the backside. You know, that's my role. So that's been a way that things have really changed. And I still have colleagues who feel umbrage. They get angry when people, you know, bring them stuff and imply that they know more than the physician does. You got to put that aside. You have to have feet of clay in this job,
right? No, and I get the pun, but I'm one of these people. And as a chaplain, part of my job at times was to help families voice the questions they wanted to ask but felt cowed to ask.
Right.
And particularly if we had kind of a surgeon who was kind of overly aggressive with certain procedures, that was, you know, as staff, the chaplains can often pose an issue to the institution that other characters can't.
Right.
Because we don't have the same kind of fat in the fire.
Yeah, I have a great relationship with the chaplain at Cougar Medical Center. His name is Tim Dean. Mm-hmm.
I work for him. That's another part of my life.
Tim officiated at my son's wedding. You know, there was really nobody that we wanted more.
Mm-hmm.
Tim's also been an angel in our life. He helped my wife and I through a really difficult patch. My wife was in a severe accident several years ago, and you know, Tim was there for me that first night, and actually said something to me that I've never forgotten. He said, "Now you're going to know the meaning of love. You're going to learn what love really means." And he was right about that, you know. Yeah. But you know, another angel.
Yep. 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 Let us cut to music.
Good deal.
On that note, and I'm going to do the station ID while you pick it.
Yep.
You're listening to WRFI Watkins Glen Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. Our guest on this hour is Lloyd Darlow. What are we playing here?
Trip to Modera. This is kind of a shorter one from Scary Vore's latest album, but again, it's just got that bagpipe that gets you going. Can't not smile when you hear this. I don't care what kind of a rotten day I'm having. Throw in a little Scary Vore and the sun comes out.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca. This is the Made of Clay Report. Our guest on this hour is Lloyd Darlow. So, Lloyd, how has life surprised you and turned out differently than what you expected?
Wow. I don't think I saw myself living in a smaller town at one point in my life. I mean, I went from the biggest city in the country to the fourth biggest city in the country to the 18th biggest city in the country to, you know, maybe the 18th biggest city in New York State. So, you know, I don't know that I necessarily saw that happening to myself. I'm much more of a big city guy. The things that I like, that I've been passionate about, I'm a big theater buff. We used to go to New York City all the time. Now we don't go very much at all. maybe it's just a matter of timing. But so I probably didn't see myself living in a smaller town at one point.
Right.
So that's changed. I think that I certainly don't know that I saw the role in medicine being what it is. I don't know that any of us maybe could have, you know, foreseen some of these changes that have come along. But, you know, one of the things that Jim Nolik taught me my first week as an intern or a resident with him in St. Louis was he said, you're not here to cure disease. You're here to advocate for your patient. And I've never forgotten that, you know, and there have been times when I've really gone toe to toe with an insurance company, with a pharmacy, you know, with somebody that I
thought specialist, I would imagine.
Yeah, there have been times, occasional, not here nearly as much. We have a very, very tight medical community here. I think probably the biggest way that things have changed is 2010, I was given the opportunity to actually to become a member of the senior leadership team at the hospital. So I'm a part-time VP at the hospital. I had to cut my practice back to do that, and thank God for my partners because they picked up the slack, and my patients have put up with me maybe not being there as much as they wanted me to be.
Sure.
And anybody who's even remotely related to this knows there's no such thing as part-time administration, and there's no such thing as being a part-time doctor. So I really have two full-time jobs.
Right.
I'm working harder now and more hours now than, you know,
20 years ago, 15 years ago.
Yeah, or some of my colleagues who were kind of, you know, on the downslide of their, you know, I'm on the back nine, as they say, but, you know,
Picking up the game.
I'm pulling more clubs out, you know, than before. I don't think before 2010, if you had told me I'd be a VP at the hospital, I'd have told you were mental, you know. Mm-hmm.
And why? So, why would you have said that?
Because I had no training in it. I mean, you know, even the fact, I mean, our practice is still a private practice. Mm-hmm. You know, nobody owns us. And you've got a bunch of physicians. None of us have MBAs. We have no business training at all, yet we, you know, we're small employers. We maybe not even so small, we employ 50 people.
Right.
You know, we have no training in that, and I certainly have no training in how to be an administrator. I don't have an MBA or an MHA, you know. So all I have is my ability, which I think is akin to being part of the Bronx, to know people. I think if there's one thing that I could say my strength is, I know people.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I can figure out what they need, what makes them tick, what makes them drive.
Right.
You know, and physicians, let me tell you, physicians have zero trust that administration cares about them at all.
Mm-hmm.
Physicians are always going to believe that administrators view them as paperclips to be shuffled around and not really important in the process. Mm-hmm. I'm happy to say that my senior leadership team here, the one I've been part of for almost 10 years now, really does care, and maybe that's because we're a community hospital, and that means a lot to us. The word community means a lot. But one of my roles has been to try to bridge that gap between the physicians and the administrative side. And there have been times in meetings where I've said, listen, I know this sounds like a good idea behind closed doors, but you got to trust me. This is not going to play well in the street with the doctors. And fortunately, you know, I'm listened to more often than I'm not, which is fine. But I never saw myself doing that 10 years ago, that's for sure.
Right. And I guess I was encouraged to go into a program to be an AOD, administrator on duty in a hospital like they had at the time in the 80s in the Columbia Presbyterian Hospital, just because of my capacity to deal with chaos and still feel be effective. But this is all about relationships, and it's what you're saying. So fundamentally, your relationship with the patient, your relationship with staff, your relationship with the institution, and how you can hold that in a way that's loving and critical at the same time.
Right.
You described the aha moment was that when you're there not to cure or treat the patient so much as to advocate for the
right.
patient. And that oftentimes means helping them to say what they can't quite put words on.
Yeah.
And then to own it, because that's where they are. What has always struck me about healthcare is we tend to look at the professionalized paid services as the most important part of healthcare. But in reality, it's how we brush our teeth, how we sleep, how we eat, how we exercise, how we take care of each other. So in terms of economic value, at some nominal value, we are producing more healthcare for ourselves and our loved ones than we are paying for, but we need them both. We have never, as a culture or as a nation, we've had healthcare debates in the 70s, healthcare debates in the late 80s and 90s, and again, you know, we've had these debates and the Affordable Care Act and all this other stuff, but we've never really talked through how is it that we actually deliver care. Why are we avoiding the conversation?
This is the one truism of the American healthcare system, and I'll put that in quotes, that you can bank on. This is the Frankenstein monster, in that there was no plan, there was no architect, there was no recipe. We have a system that came together slapdash along the way. Mm-hmm. And then when you layer on top of that the political footballness of healthcare, I mean, right. It's who has the football, and then the other party will say, well, that the current party has botched it.
Right.
Then they get it punted back to them, and then they botch it for a while, and all the while let's throw another bolt, couple of bolts in here. Let's throw another head on it. Let's, you know, take a nose off somebody else and slap it on the monster. So we have this monster system that had no architect, and it makes zero sense. It never made any sense.
Right.
And then we're and those of us who are, you know, kind of, not to use a war analogy lightly, but those of us who are on the front lines of it, with people who need care and can't afford it. You know, Mrs. Jones, you know, why did you stop taking your blood pressure medicine? It was pay for that or pay the electrical bill in the winter.
Right,
I mean,
right.
You know, these are things that break your heart. I mean, you know, one of the advantages, if you want to call it that, which is also a disadvantage of being the owner of a private practice, is I can make those decisions for myself, you know, if I, you know, to eat a bill as opposed
right.
to
right.
enforcing a bill. But then you juggle that with the fact that your employees want to get paid and NYSEG wants to turn the lights on.
Right. But you know,
it's a challenge. It's
even, the front line is also the person themselves and how they care for themselves, the people near them. And the Affordable Care Act set aside some resources for the most ill people to foster those relationships, but we're still avoiding it.
I'll tell you where the whole thing fell apart to me on the affordable care side. So we're going to insure 37 million Americans now. Who's taking care of them? We don't have 37 million doctors. I mean, in fact, if you look at the cost of a medical education now, if you're a lucky resident of the great state of Texas and you get into one of the Texas medical schools, you pay nothing. To go to my old medical school, which is now Drexel, you know, it's going to be 50 plus grand, you know, a year. I mean, there are students coming out of medical school now, you know, $300,000-$400,000 in debt.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
I mean, so nobody's going to primary care. All those people want to go into orthopedics or dermatology where they can make
get
a boatload of money.
Yeah, yeah.
In primary care, there's not any money. And so, yet we need primary care docs, providers, to take care of 37 million newly insured Americans. It's idiocy. They should have layered onto that a plan, you know, to say, almost like a military requirement.
Right.
If you're going to go into primary care, you know, your medical school tuition is going to be significantly discounted.
If you do it for that a would number
have
of years.
Right. Yeah. That would have made sense, yeah, but there's no sense to it.
Right. So let's switch gears here.
Mm-hmm.
The way we're coming down to the last, you know, 14, 15 minutes of the show, and what I like to close with is, how do you... when did you learn that it's your job to take care of yourself? physically, emotionally, intellectually, and other people around you.
Yeah.
And how do you know you need to do that? And what do you do?
Yeah. Well, I'm not sure that I do. I wish I had a great answer for
that. Most people don't. You know, most people have a cobbled together.
You know, I think I heard you ask Jeff that question on his show. Like, how do you deal with stress? And I mean, I'm not sure that I do. I mean, you do things in the moment sometimes. I play tennis. I mean, that's one thing that I do to try to take care of my body and. Mm-hmm. You know, I have people that I play with where we're playing for exercise. I have people who I play with, like my good friend Sanjeev Vohra. We're just out there to trash talk each other and have a good time.
Right.
You know, and so you know, you get different things from different people.
Sure.
I do tell my patients that it's critical that you carve out time for yourself that can't be touched. This is my time to.
And what is that time for
you? It could be exercise. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I refer to my life as DBM, death by meeting. You know, and there have been times when I've told my colleagues, I'm not coming to this meeting because I haven't had a chance to exercise this week or to have dinner with my family. I'm doing it. Get on without me. You know, none of us are indispensable. You can do this meeting without me tonight. We have to do that. Now, I realize not everybody can do that. Not everybody is their own boss. I was lucky, again, my own boss in this practice. My middle son was a swimmer throughout middle school, high school, college, even swam in grad school. I never missed one of his meets. You know, that was just important to me that I carved that time out. Not everybody can do that. So you have to take the opportunities where you can. You know, and whether that's exercise, whether it's meditation, whether it's reading, listening to music, talking to your spouse, you've got to carve that time out. Mm-hmm. So in terms of exercise, this is a good one. I tell people all the time, try everything because you never know what you're going to like. I mean, mm-hmm. I dragged my wife to a martial arts class, and we don't punch other people. We're just basically, you know, shadow boxing,
right?
You know, but it's aerobics, and you know, and you're doing the same kind of motions, kickboxing, that kind of stuff. And she's like, I'm not going to do this. And I said, just come once, and she loved it. And you know, so we've been doing that for like 6 years now, and we do it together, you know, which is a lot of fun. In fact, when she wasn't able to exercise, and I would go, I hated it because she wasn't there. You know, I missed her presence there, but. You know, if she had never done that with me, she'd have never known that was something she would enjoy. So I tell people, in this area, you know, there is the natural beauty. You can bike, you can hike, mm-hmm. you can walk. There's tons of yoga. I mean, coming here from St. Louis, I'm like, yoga? What, are you kidding me? You know, my patients who do yoga are in far better mental and physical shape than those who don't. So if you don't think that you might like yoga, take a yoga class. What do you got to lose? Right. You might find that it's just what you're looking for. So I tell people, try everything. You will find right. – and then here's the deal. When you find something that you like, then it doesn't work anymore. For Dr. Darlow to say, you got to exercise, that sounds like work.
Right.
You'll do it for 2 weeks, like a diet, and you'll forget about it. But if you like it and you love it, then it becomes part of what you do. You will make it part of your mm-hmm. day, yep. and then no one can touch that time.
Right. For me, that time is an hour of reading in the morning.
Yeah.
Usually news.
What do you read? Oh, news? Okay.
Usually news. And essays and stuff like that. That is my time, and people don't mess with it. It could be at 4 o'clock or 5 o'clock or 6 o'clock, but it's the first hour of the day for me, and don't come between that and my coffee.
So I do the exact same thing. But I guarantee you what I read is not what you read. I read the New York Post every morning. I read the New York Post.
Yep.
You know, I read the Times for lunch, but I read the New York Post in the morning.
And you got to fix it, and you got to figure out what works for you. For me, walking works, and vigorous walking, as fast as I can, and for 45 minutes to an hour. You know, and if I can do it every day, and if I do it for 2 hours because I've got extra time, that's fine.
Yeah.
The other piece that I wanted to kind of, in terms of finding, you find something you love and stick with it, and then find something else when you don't love it anymore. But how do you know that you need to take a time out? What happens in your life or what happens in your awareness that says, oops?
Yeah. For me, I withdraw. You know, in fact, my family will notice that, you know, those who've read the, you know, the Dr. Seuss book, The Lorax, you know the term the lurkum, you know, the Lorax, you know. They say, well, Dad's going to his lurkum, you know, and yep. I'll just basically wall myself off and do a crossword puzzle or you know, catch up on email or watch a bad movie, but I'm by myself. And I am not a person who likes to be by himself. I like to be with other people. So that's how I know that I'm getting in a bad place.
Right.
You know, I have the tendency to just, you know, hibernate in my lurkum, and that's not good. And that's not good.
Right. But it seems like it may be good in that you mm-hmm. get aware that you need yeah. to do something else, and you get enough time there that you can come out and do something else.
Yeah. You know, when I see my colleagues getting complaining about medicine and what medicine's become mm-hmm. and, sure. and all that, I try to remind them, because I think about this a lot, you know, how you felt the day you got your medical school acceptance letter. I mean, when that you held that letter in your hand mm-hmm. and you knew that, you know, one in like 1,000 people got in. I mean, it was, you know, so hard to do. And you would have gladly cut off the other arm if in that letter, you know, envelope was a letter saying congratulations and not, you know, we regret to tell you, mm-hmm, you know.
Sure.
So when doctors are getting burnt out, I tell them, go back to the joy you felt the day you got your medical school letter. That's helped me, you know, along mm-hmm. along the years when I felt that kind of burnout coming in. But you just got to figure out, you know, why did I get into this business? And I don't want to hear people say, well, I wouldn't have gotten into it if I knew it was coming. Yes, you would have.
Right.
Yes,
right,
you would
have. Right. We tend to, as with medicine and mm-hmm. with self-care, we tend to focus on it as almost an individual sport.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we treat the patient. But how come we don't look at self-care or medicine as a team sport?
Oh, you and I, we don't have enough time to go into that. I've got.
Well, no.
Here's the basic sure. answer. Physicians are not trained initially to be team players because it's so hard to get into medical school. You know, you're told when you're in high school, you got to be better than everybody else in your class. Then you get into medical school. But now, you know, I want to be a dermatologist or a radiologist. I have to be at the very top of my class. So you don't work collaboratively. You're watching out mm-hmm. for your own flank. Then you finally get out into the real world, and then you're told, okay, now collaborate with your colleagues. Why? We were never taught to do that. Right. We were never trained that way. So, you know, I think it's really important that people realize it was a stupid system to begin with, and I'm sorry that that was the way it was, right. but we have to collaborate.
And it's a system that grew up in the middle part of the 20th century
right.
when individualism was at its height, when objectivity and rationalism were kind of at their height, right. and we have not grown up.
But medicine's one of those professions, maybe the only profession, where the day you graduate, you're pretty much guaranteed a job and a decent lifestyle. I mean, unless you are truly incompetent, and believe me, there are enough checkpoints along the way that they're truly incompetent, don't graduate. So if you get all the way through, you know, so...
You can be negligent, but not necessarily incompetent.
Exactly. But I think that, you know, so the competition, even though you're right, and we're not necessarily in the me generation like we were, the competition still makes us look out for ourselves.
Right. But the team that matters to mm-hmm. me more is how are all of the people around that person working together?
Right.
And the physician and the nurses yeah. and the aides, but it's also the cousin and the neighbor mm-hmm. and when you practice really community medicine, you know the people who've known this person yeah. for decades.
Yeah. And that's what draws you to a place like this.
Well, yeah, yeah. But the thing is you also when you know how to deal with HIPAA, so you don't violate confidentiality, right. but you work friendship networks, yeah. legitimately work friendship networks, yeah. you can help people write themselves that don't necessarily involve money. Now, yeah. some of it does, because things have to be paid for. But a lot of care, no money yeah. changes hands.
Yeah, I think it's important when you're dealing with people always to find out who their support system is. You know, who are the people who you need to have on your side to try to affect the positive change?
And it's not just the checklist on the interview that's about. It's like, what kind of person is that person? How do they respond to crisis news? How do they, are they reliable? Yeah. Do they show up with food?
Yeah.
Or do they come like 4 hours late, but they come through?
But let me tell you again, you know, I alluded to my wife's accident. We would not have made it through that process without this community. People that we didn't know cooked for us, brought, I mean, for 2 months we didn't have to cook dinner. People would show up with food. I don't, you know, again, I don't think we saw ourselves living in a small community 15 years ago, but, you know, this community pulled us through, and we you couldn't get us out of here now with the National Guard.
Right. And I have seen that happen in New York. I've seen that happen in the Bronx. I've seen it happen in Manhattan, but it's where people are. There are enough people in your lives and people know they talk to each other. What makes a community is communication, not whether it's a big space or a small space.
Agreed.
It's just whether you talk to each other.
And you're a big part of that.
But, well, thank you. But it's been wonderful to get to know you.
It's been a pleasure here as well. Thank you so much.
We're going to end with what, Path to Home?
Yeah, best one to end with, right?
You lined them up just right here.
Yep.
Yeah. Here we go.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Forgotten souls start their journey home, with the sound of their heartbeat racing, the clans begin embracing a bridge forever, a path to home. Forever we may go, our bloodline flows. Gathering has to end now, with last words spoken, as our people leave again 1,000 miles.